I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. Welcome to Minute 8 of Season 6 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic It's a Wonderful Life, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com and a whole bunch of Movies by Minute shows. Welcome back, Jim.
Hey, Rob. Thanks again for having me on. This has been a really fun week.
Yeah. It's always fun talking to you, even if we have to whisper, you know,
in
your bad ear.
In your banner, yes.
So minute 8 begins with Mary finishing her secret and ends with Gower dropping a bunch of pills.
Ooh, whoops.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not a good day.
not a good day for anybody. Yeah. So basically, actually, if you think about it, I don't think anyone has a good day today. I mean, just thinking about what happens in this day in the movie to everyone.
That's true.
You know, Mary sort of gets brushed off by George. Gower, we'll talk about today why it's such a bad day for him. George ends up getting beaten, and he gets ignored by his father. Then he gets beaten, okay, so that's not a good day for him. Uncle Billy, we'll talk about a little bit. We'll talk about, I think, on Friday. You know, it's not a good day for him because he once again forgot something. Peter Bailey, it's not a good day for him because he gets embarrassed in front of his son. I guess Potter's the only one who has a good day because he gets to be a mean old bastard.
You gotta remember, Violet did score that sweet, sweet licorice for only 2 cents. She got a pretty good deal. He's heavy-handed on handing over the licorice.
So basically, the only people who have a good day today are Violet and Mr. Potter.
Yeah.
Okay. Harry Potter. Henry Harry Potter. And it's because he must be using that black magic.
Yeah. So we're getting into Mary's giving him an ear test.
That's right. And basically, you know, I like the way that they give us this great exposition about who Mary is, that Mary is madly in love with George. You know, and George is completely in the dark about this. He has no idea. You know, because she finishes her sentence by saying, "George Bailey, I'll love you till the day I die."
Well, I don't think he was even picking up the clues that Violet was dropping. He's really bad about women.
Which is really funny based on the next thing that he says. You know, he stands up completely oblivious to everything and then says, "I'm going out exploring someday. You watch. And I'm going to have a couple of harems and maybe 3 or 4 wives. Wait and see." You know, maybe he needs 3 or 4 wives because he doesn't know how to pay attention to any of them. So he's got 3 of them that are upset at him at the same time, while there's one who's not, you know.
Yeah, he's really got to work on his game. He's really bad at all this.
Yes, especially if he wants a hair. But it's just very, very interesting. So what is a harem?
I think you're going to tell us.
I know, but I was asking first if Jim.
Oh, okay. Well, I think it just means women in your household. I don't think it had like I think the actual terminology is like women who live in a household. I may
That's
be
right.
wrong.
That's right. It's female members of the family. That's all it is. You know,
yeah.
But in you know when you see harems in movies or when you read about them in books and stuff like that, you know, where they're, you know, you have the Sultan with his harem and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Those are basically all his wives. So, you know, his wives and his concubines and all that stuff. So these are just the women of his household. It's not, you know, it makes it sound as if it's a, you know, a house of ill repute where people are, you know, that's what's going on, but it's not, it's a family structure. You know, which is interesting the way that you know we think of the kind of connotation of it, but that's wrong. You know, as you said, it just means the female members of the family.
Yeah, I mean, my son has a harem. He's got a wife and three daughters, so it's
But if he goes around telling people I have a harem at home, people are not going to think of that. You know?
No, it's going to come across the wrong. You know, we have a. I think. You know, thanks Hollywood. Thanks a bunch.
That's right.
And the weirdest thing, when you think of the word harem, you instantly hear an oboe playing in a minor key. It's just one of those things. It's the same thing when you think snake charmer.
That's right.
But it's very, but, and he, you know, it's like, was this in your National Geographic, George? Are you reading are you just looking at the pictures or what? You know,
I have a feeling that it is. But again, apparently he doesn't really understand everything he's reading in there. I mean, you mentioned yesterday that the National Geographic would come in this brown paper bag. You know, I remember it was a known thing, you know, when I was a kid, that people were talking about, oh, you can go to the library and you can look at, pictures of women in Africa. You know, in the National Geographic, you know, if it's coming in a brown paper bag, you know, it has a different type of connotation.
And it's like back then they didn't even have pictures on the front of the National Geographic. But when you opened it up, it was like, oh, my goodness.
That's right.
But
it's science, right? Yeah. All in the name of good science.
George was getting it for the articles, I'm sure.
That's right. So, of course. He was reading the interviews. Yes.
Yeah.
The fact that he also mentions that he wants to have three or four wives. So I guess he wants to be a polygamist.
Yeah, but apparently he can't deal with one or two women. I don't know what he's going to do with three or four of them. It's just,
that's right.
It's just,
I mean, again, as someone who's been married, you know, happily, and you know, I don't understand why someone wants a second wife, you know, at the same time. one is more than enough.
There was a Robert Sheckley short story, and it was about this guy gets visited by the devil, and apparently hell is full, so they're trying to stop people from sinning by having them doing good deeds. And so he said he gave him a wish, and he gave him three wishes, and so he said, Whatever you wish for, your worst enemy will get twice that. He said, so if I wish for $1 million, because that's right, your worst enemy would get $2 million. He says, if I wish for double pneumonia, or if I wish for pneumonia, yeah, you'd get double pneumonia, so you don't want to do that either. So he made a wish, and he wound up with he wished for 1,000 pounds of sardines, and so he got 1,000 pounds of sardines. And he sold off half of them, ate a half a pound of them, and then he threw away the rest. And he found out that his worst enemy, who used to be a coworker that he thought was his friend, got twice that and made twice as much money selling the sardines. So then he asked for $1 million, and then his worst enemy got $2 million. And he said, so his final wish was, I wished for the most wonderful wife I could ever have. And so his worst enemy wound up with two of the most wonderful women he could ever have, and he couldn't handle he couldn't make both of them happy at the same time, because they were both wonderful, and he was, you know, tormented forever. So it's like, this George has not learned to be careful. You know, it's the monkey's paw kind of a thing.
That's right.
Be careful what you wish for.
I thought the whole joke was that he asked to be beaten half to death.
I've
heard that also somewhere. Yeah. Now, did you notice that as George is talking, he's basically, waving the scoop with chocolate at her, but it's not splashing onto her. You know, he's quite lucky that he didn't ruin Mary's dress by getting it filled with chocolate. You know, that ice cream really sticks to the scoop.
Yeah, it's probably a gray mashed potatoes or something. But he's using a different spoon. And He apparently ignored her on the coconut issue. It's like, I don't
I
want
was just
coconut.
About to get there.
Yeah, you're getting coconut whether you like. We've got a lot of coconut here.
And he gives her a lot of coconut. Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, did you also notice that on the register right next to him, you see it's registered as 2 cents.
Yeah, so he did enter Violet's last
right.
purchase.
That's right.
Gary's going to have to close up early with that kind of money coming in.
That's right. And as he's working, he's whistling. You know, he keeps whistling, and then we hear Gower bark from George. George, he goes, "Yes, sir. You're not paid to be a canary."
Wow, Warner is amazing in this. I mean, those watery. I know he's probably like dropping in glycerin drops or something like that. But just that
they claim that he was drunk when he was doing the scene, in order to get into. You know, he's a method actor. You know,
I can't imagine. I mean, Warner he's amazing. If you watch any of his movies, he's just stunning. But maybe he did. I don't know. Who knows? It's just that little gigolo of a mustache that he's got. It's just looks horrible.
And he talks with the cigar in his mouth. He looks like I don't know why I was thinking Popeye, but someone, you know, one of the,
there used to be a cartoon called Courageous Cat and Minute Mouse. And there was a frog in there, and the frog always, I think it was just called the frog. And he would talk with a cigar in his mouth, and the cigar would bounce up and down while it was chatting. Mm-hmm. And he does look like a cartoon character here. It's just, the long thinning hair and just the vest he has on, he just doesn't look like he's put together very well now.
No, not at all. And George notices that there's something wrong here. You know, you can see the look on his face as he's putting all of this coconut on the ice cream that she specifically asked not to give him.
Yeah, he's given like extra, extra, extra. So
that's right. He's like, "You don't like it? This is what you're gonna get." And then he sees a piece of paper on the register, which he should have noticed before when he actually put the 2 cents in the register, you know, for the licorice that Violet bought, but he apparently didn't. And then we get a close up of this telegram, and you know, it says Bedford Falls, New York, QAB 605313X, May 3rd, 1919. So we were talking earlier in the week about when this takes place. So this is basically May 3rd. May 3rd was a Saturday,
right?
In 1919, you know. So
that's why all the girls were in. You know, they weren't at school. They were in having ice cream.
That's right.
And we were on the third.
And he's allowed to be open, you know, legally in Bedford.
Yeah.
Hall. You know,
and
do you see that it was sent at 12:11 a.m.?
Yeah. So right in the middle of the night, I guess he died at midnight, and they got it right out to him and said, suddenly this morning being after midnight.
Well, again, the question is, and I'll read through what it says here first, and then we'll ask that question.
Sure.
There is a glaring question here. So it says Mr. Emil Gower. So we find out that Mr. Gower's first name is Emil. Do you know what that name means? The meaning of the name Emil?
I do not know.
It is either a rival or trying to equal or emulate someone.
I know. I was trying to remember Emiles in movie history, and the only other Emil I could think of,
Emil Jennings, is the one I was thinking of.
Oh, I was thinking of characters in movies. The police officer in Long Island who arrested Roger Thornhill in North by Northwest was named Lieutenant Emil, and Roger Thornhill was kind of shocked that his first name was Emil. But he was the only other Emil I could think of in movie characters.
Okay,
but
right. I didn't check it up. I didn't check to try and find how many Emils, how many known Emils there are in movies. I just found it interesting. It sounds like it's basically a German name. So, but Gower does not sound German. So
no, it sounds either Welsh or Irish, even.
That's right. And I heard that the name Gower in this movie came from the fact that it was a street that was like near the studio.
Paramount has the Gower Street Gate
there,
which runs in front of Hollywood High School as well.
All right.
I do notice at the top of the page at Western Union Telegram, they mention Newcomb Carlton, who was the president Western Union at a very timely moment, because in 1918, the year before this, when the telegraph industry was nationalized and placed under government control, he moved from being president of Western Union to the director of all cable lines in the United States.
There you go. And the first vice president was George W. E. Atkins.
Wow, I do not know about him. I'm not sure what his history was. Yeah, but
I don't either. I didn't look it up. So the telegram that he has here says, we regret to inform you that your son Robert died very suddenly this morning of influenza. Stop. Everything possible was done for his comfort. Stop. We await instructions from you. Stop. Edward Millington, President, Hamerton College.
I could not find a Hamerton College.
Neither could I. The closest I could find is there are two counties in northern Yorkshire, England. One of them is called Green Hamerton, and the other one was called Kirk Hamerton. These are parishes in the Harrogate district. That's as close as I could find. Now, for some reason, I always thought that this came from England, you know, which is why I was talking about before about the time discrepancy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, so it could be a might have happened at 6 a.m. or something, and this was just local.
That's right. For some reason, I think it's in England, but you know, we're never really sure where this telegram is coming from. You know, and so one of the things that I decided to look up was, like, you know, for telegrams, you would pay basically per word or per letter. You know, you have the famous you know, joke in the Three Amigos, you know, where they want to send a telegram and they cut out a whole bunch of different things, which completely changes the meaning of the telegram, because that's all the money they have to be able to pay for it. I mean, this is a very long telegram.
Yeah, this is big money, especially if it's writing Hamerton College.
That's right. Well, the president of Hamerton College was very sorry about this whole thing, and therefore now in what do you think the average length of a telegram was in the early 1900s in the U.S.?
Wasn't there something like 10 words or less? I believe was what it might have been. I'm not sure if that's an average.
Okay, you were very close. The average was 11.93 words, but more than half of those messages were either 10 words or fewer.
Ah, wow. Yeah, I think that it went up over a certain price.
That's right. And in England, that number was higher. The average was 14.6 words. And German telegrams were 11.5 words.
Wow. I know famous.
Think about how many words they have here. Now, yeah. I mean, the stop doesn't count, which I find really funny that you know, instead of just putting a dot, you know, as a period, you have to actually write out the word stop.
Did he really need to stuff like we await instructions? Does he really need to say from you?
He couldn't. Well, he wasn't paying for the letters. So if he was paying for these letters, he would just write the letter U, you know, as, you know, the way that everyone shortens things nowadays, you know.
Yeah, there's a famous, if apocryphal, story about the shortest telegram was between Victor Hugo and his publisher, which he was wondering. It was, I think it was in the 1860s sometime, and he had sent a telegram to his publisher, and all he had included on it was a question mark, and his publisher sent back an exclamation mark. So,
yes. So there, when you count the words, so you only count the message itself, or do you count the names of the people in there also? Because the message itself is just 30 words. But then if you add in the Edward Millington, President of Hamerton College, you get another 5 words right there. And then you have, you know, Mr. Emil Gower, Bedford Falls, New York. Once again, you're adding letters there also.
Yeah, think how much that is in licorice.
Seriously,
it's I'm not sure. I mean, this reminds me of back in the day, us old folks, when you'd call home and you'd leave a collect call from a Mr. Skating is over, pick me up, and but I guess these don't. I don't think people game the system as much as they would later on. It just seems like this would be something possible to do.
That's right. Yeah, no, it's just it's interesting the way that and while they're showing us this, you can see that part of it seems to be highlighted, that part of the letter is lighter than the rest of it in order for us to focus on that. And then the camera actually zooms in, to tell us that, that this is from influenza. Now, because this was in 1919, so we all know. Especially now, anyone who knows history of COVID, it was 100 years since the Spanish flu in 1918.
You just want to avoid the 1919, anything ending in 19 or 20. You just want to stay away from that part of us any century.
That's right. I think most of us are safe now, because we will probably not be around the next time those numbers show up. And
Well.
Oh
We're gonna,
yeah.
yeah,
Well, who knows?
yeah,
It's possible.
yeah.
But
Yeah,
so
especially if you don't have,
the assumption is that his son died from the Spanish flu.
yeah.
Whether it is or isn't, there's no way of really knowing. But and the Spanish flu was it didn't hit the U.S., did it?
Yeah, oh, it did. It returning soldiers brought it back. There were massive. I know in Texas they lost lots of people. The actually, if I had bothered to write it all down, the flu hit every continent, I believe. The
So
U.S.
do you think that
you
means his son is somewhere in the U.S.? I don't know why I always
could be.
thought his son was overseas.
It killed 50 million people. Now the minority of them were in the U.S. About 675,000 deaths were in the United States in 1919. So a lot of returning soldiers. 33% of the world's population were infected. So estimated 500 million people globally. So 1 out of 10 of those 500 million people died. Yeah, actually, it's the U.S. suffered more casualties from the flu than they did in battle from World War One.
I see a different source that also says that they 675,000 people died in the U.S. in 1918 and 1919 from the Spanish flu.
Yeah, grim.
Right. But we don't know where their college is.
No, it could be anywhere. I mean, and it's a worldwide, that's why they called it a pandemic, but it could be anywhere where he died. But we don't really get any clues onto where he sent him or where he was studying.
Right.
I would
Well,
assume.
as we know, it's from a place that has a lot of money to be able to send a very long,
Yeah,
telegram.
look, yeah, spare no expense.
That's right. Because it makes it sound as if the college is at fault. Because it's as if they're apologizing, that we
Yeah, that's
couldn't
right.
do more.
Yeah, I mean, how many of these? How they must have had more than one death at Hammingham College, whatever the name of the. How many people had died? Maybe this was their form letter, and they just never thought. If we're going to send out about 60 of these, we're going to really be in trouble on the telegram budget.
Yeah, I'm not really sure about that. So I mean, this is great way. This is a great way for Capra to give us this information without having to say it. You don't need to really use exposition. George is reading this telegram, and George now knows what the story is, and that's it.
Yeah, and this is only 25 years in the past. The theater goers, it's only 25 years in their past. So, this is all you have to do is see the word influenza, and you know what it meant.
Right. Correct. And then
So,
we see George's face, and George already knows what this means. Here you have a
yeah.
12-year-old boy that understands the meaning of something like this.
Yeah. So, and Gower usually, maybe Gower is normally a talkative guy, and he's just
Right.
disappeared, being surly. So,
Correct. And
going in the back there and trying to investigate.
that's right. And it already shows us what type of personality George has. George wants to help others. I mean, that is his motivation for everything. That's why he wants to travel the world and build things and stuff like that. He doesn't want to do it for himself. You see in all of his actions throughout this movie, and even his words of what he wants to do, he wants to help others.
Yes.
You never hear him say anything selfish, except for the fact that he wants to travel to be able to help others. That's as selfish as George gets in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, he pictures himself as, you know, the global explorer, maybe writing articles for National Geographic and spreading his knowledge of what he's found out on his travels.
That's right.
To other people to let them know all about coconuts.
That's right. But he sees that Gower has received this telegram, and immediately you see on his face he wants to go help Gower.
Yeah. Yeah, he just wants to do something for him. Anything I can do to help, and is there anything you want to talk about? That kind of stuff.
He's just and he looks like he's in a daze also, because like the way that he just puts the ice cream on the counter and doesn't even look at Mary. You know, he's just concerned about, you know, he's focused just on Gower.
Yeah.
And then he walks to the back and he goes, "Mr. Gower, do you want something? Do you want anything?" And Gower goes, "No." He goes, "Anything I can do back here?" You know, he constantly wants to help here.
Yeah.
And, you know, we see Gower in the back, you know, putting pills in a container. You know, and it's funny that it looks like he's putting them in like a, you know, a little box that you put ammunition in. You know, the way that he's putting it in the little box. He's just putting the pills in there.
Yeah, it looked like he emptied out a matchbox and just. But apparently, that's from what I've been looking at in old pictures of prescriptions. That's pretty much how they were sent out. They were put in little sliding boxes.
Right. Okay, and then we see a shot on the from Gower's feet.
Yes, and George's feet.
And George's feet, but we see Gower. Gower is basically moving back and forth. You see his foot lift up. He's basically swaying back and forth, showing that he's unstable. Yeah. And then we see 9 pills fall on the ground. You know, as he's trying to put them into this box.
Yeah, you know, and they just have a printed linoleum floor, which is, you know, era appropriate.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's definitely, you know, out of it. And beautiful editing. It just matches. It's matching your mind follows where things are happening. Where
That's right. And then he pulls out his cigar, you know, that he's been chomping on.
Yeah.
And basically, at this point, you know, we hear George say, "I'll get them, sir." You know, he wants to lean down and pick up the stuff, and he goes, "Quick, take these capsules over to Mrs." And then he gets cut off. So we don't get to hear. Tomorrow, people have to come back to find out who gets these
capsules. Yeah, find out who it was, yeah.
Who gets these capsules? You know, it's Russian roulette with Mr. Gower.
Yeah. And, you know, and you think about the horror of it all for him is he deals with disease every day.
That's
he knows
right.
everybody in town who's sick. And his son, who he would have wanted to treat, is too far away to save. So the one man who may have been able to help more, or even, you know, to provide comfort, he's not there for him. So it's just that just must prey on his mind, especially when he knows how many other sick people there are.
That's right, because you know who knows where Hamilton College is. Far, far away. That's right, and that's how this minute ends. Did you have anything else you want to say about this minute?
I was going to look up, I wrote it down and I never looked it up, but I didn't know what, there's a bunch of old, there's old terms for, medications on the wall behind Gower. And there was something called, calamus. And as far as I can tell, it was used to,
on the top shelf, right?
On the top shelf, calamus. Yeah. And it was kind of a general purpose thing. It was used for stomach problems, skin problems, earaches, and to remove the smell of tobacco. But there is no good
science. It's like Windex.
Yeah, exactly. there's no scientific evidence to support that it worked about anything. So it's they said that it might be something that helps. It might reduce muscle. It might relax muscles, and it might reduce swelling. But nobody knows. And that apparently, all they know is it does. You know, there is no proof of any of that stuff. but people still believe in it, and it's a very common weed apparently. So
weed isn't weed, or weed isn't.
No, just weed isn't just a dandelion kind of thing. It's just out there and around, but used commonly in Chinese, Nepal, and Indian herbal traditions. And it was also used by the Chippewa natives of Kansas. And
it's also a spice that people use in food.
There you go. So all the many use, maybe, you know, he might have been running a salad bar at the, you know, at the same time he was running the ice cream stand.
Well, they say, it kills insects, cancer cells, and reduces swelling. There you go.
Sure it does. Yeah. Oh, you can, you know, report back if that's how it works.
That's
So it's and it's a, apparently it grows pretty much everywhere. You can find it in India, Asia, Russia, Siberia, Europe, and North America. So if you're in a temperate climate, you can probably find some out in your backyard or in a swamp. I think it grows in a swamp.
Right.
So wow. So that's that's all I've got for this minute.
So on Wednesdays we have a segment called "It's a Wonderful Wednesday," where basically the whole idea is that ever since this movie came out, the idea of this movie has been used as a trope in many TV shows, movies, I even found in songs, comic books, a whole bunch of places where you take the idea where you have a character who wishes either that something is changed in their life, whether it's that they no longer are there or whether that they made a different decision at a certain point in their life and stuff like that. So, you know, I have created a list of all of these various tropes. Most of them are from places where I'm familiar with the references, and each week I talk about one of them. So this week I decided to talk about an episode of the TV show Mork and Mindy, which the episode is called "It's a Wonderful Mork." It was the second to last episode of the first season. I actually just rewatched it. You can even find it on YouTube, where Mork annoys Mindy, her father. He basically annoys everyone around him, and he decides that, you know, because they're so upset at him, maybe their lives will be much better if he wasn't around. So he asks Orson to take him away from Earth. And Orson says, "I'm going to do one better, and I'm actually going to let you see what would have happened to these characters had you not shown up, you know, a year ago to change their lives." So we find out that, so just for anyone who isn't familiar, Mork and Mindy is a TV show from the late 1970s, starring Pam Dauber and Robin Williams, which was basically his breakout role. This was a pseudo spinoff of Happy Days, because Mork showed up on Happy Days before he got his own show. It takes place in Denver, and the idea is
Boulder,
Colorado. Excuse me. And the idea here is that you have Mork, who is an alien from the planet Ork, who shows up on Earth and falls in love with an aspiring journalist named Mindy. And her father owns a music store. And, you know, when I rewatched this episode, I was just floored about the amount of improv that Robin Williams must do in every one of these episodes. You know, it was just amazing watching it. So basically the premise of the episode is that Mork, you know, Mork is shown what life would be like if he hadn't shown up. And Mindy ends up getting married to this guy who has a gambling issue and bosses her around and makes her get two jobs. One is a waitress, and another, I don't remember, maybe the other one is a secretary, in order to be able to pay their bills. You know, she's in a very unhappy marriage. Her father has sold his store and went on a whirlwind tour of the world. He comes back talking about, you know, all the women that he met and stuff like that. But in the end, we find out that, you know, he was making it all up. He really did not enjoy himself during this whole trip. And then the grandmother also is not happy that the way that her life has gone, because she now is living with Mindy and her new husband. And Mork learns a lesson from this, obviously, that you know, their lives are all better off with the fact that he is in their lives, and he has made things better. And, at a certain point, Mork says, "Oh, it's a wonderful life." And then, he also mentions the fact that, well, if you have friends, then, then your life will be richer, basically quoting from this movie. So I think that's a nice tribute to this movie. The episode came out approximately 32 years after the movie itself, and I enjoyed rewatching it, and I recommend that people take a look at it if you are so inclined. It's a nice 24 minutes just to see what would happen to Mork or what would happen to everyone else if Mork did not show up. Huh. Yeah.
Best so, trope, yeah.
Yeah, it is. It really is. All right. So, Jim, you want to tell people where they can get in touch with Jim O'Kane?
Well, you can find me on, I don't know, I've lost count of how many different podcasts we've been doing. One I can recommend if you want to just dip your toe in to see what I talk about when I'm on different podcasts. Actually a podcast that Rob is listening to at the moment, the Apollo 13 Minute, where we cover.
I'm hoping by the time that this show airs, I've already finished it.
I got
30 episodes left. So
yeah, so he's back in there. We recorded the 1995 Ron Howard film Apollo 13, 1 minute of screen time per episode, and not only did we get to talk to people who helped make the movie a little bit. Players and things like that, some players that were on screen. We didn't get to talk to Tom Hanks. I have to warn you, we were hoping to get Tom Hanks, and accidentally moved to Greece during the times, and we couldn't line stuff up with his press people, but we almost got Tom Hanks. Just as a nice consolation, we do have astronaut Fred Hayes among some other real life people that participated in the Apollo 13 saga. And Fredo was a really, the actual lunar module pilot. He was a great guest. We had a bunch of people that put this together. We had people that had been mission controllers, all the different aspects of our flights to the moon. And I had a great time. My co-host, Chris Henry, who has the world's greatest Rolodex, he knows all these folks, got us some really great guests. We had some great conversations. So if you want to check that out, it's Apollo 13 Minute, available at apollo13minute.com or wherever popular podcasts are carried.
And I can attest to it that it's so much fun listening to all these people talking about it. Someone said to me that, there are podcasts that are entertaining and then there are podcasts that are informational. And Apollo 13 to me is both, because it's so entertaining listening to these real life people, and obviously Jim and Chris talk about everything that's going on in the movie, but it's just, there's so much information about the Apollo missions and, little tidbits and anecdotes of things that happened to the astronauts or that happened to you guys when you've met some of these, astronauts or flight controllers over the years and stuff like that. It's just a lot of fun. So anyone, and the episodes are not as long as the episodes that Jim and I do here. They're usually about 20, 25 minutes. So, you can get them done a little quicker inclined.
Our target audience is people who live about maybe 10 to 15 miles from work and need to listen to something short before they get into the parking lot. That's where we aim. If you're on a train, it should be about a 20 minute ride. No more than that. That's what we're aiming for.
Exactly. So yes, go check that out. That I highly recommend that. And while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe on the podcatcher you might be using to listen to the show. Finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Move Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter, and you can find me on my website, movearoundminute.com. So until tomorrow, hot dog.
Hot dog.
I love you truly, truly dear. Life with its sorrow, life with its tears.